At best, we could only say the type of corruption in China is good for risky imbalance growth. But is that good? It's not good, right? And I know that people may find that unsatisfying because, hey, I want you to tell me what is the silver bullet to this utopian world where there is rapid growth and absolute no social cost. I don't have this silver bullet. I've never found one.
You are listening to In Pursuit of Development with Dan Banik.
China has not only achieved impressive economic growth in recent decades, but has also managed to lift hundreds of millions of its citizens out of poverty. How was this possible? What role did Chinese institutions, leaders and bureaucrats play in achieving this impressive result? And how and why has China managed to grow so fast for so long despite pervasive corruption? These are some of the questions that I discussed with my guest today. Yuan Ang is a professor of political science and an expert on China at the University of Michigan. She has written two very impressive and award-winning books. In her first book, How China Escaped the Poverty Trap, published in 2016, she explains how policymakers were able to design national reform packages and were thus able to create an adaptive environment around the bureaucracy. Local governments also played a key role in achieving poverty reduction in China. And in this book, Yuan argues that China's rise was not the result of top-down control, but rather of so-called directed improvisation within a single-party regime. In her most recent book, China's Gilded Age, The Paradox of Economic Boom and Vast Corruption, that was published earlier this year, Yuan challenges the conventional wisdom that rich countries became rich by first eradicating corruption. She argues in this book that the dominant type of corruption in China is not petty bribery or outright looting, but access money. That is elite exchanges of power and wealth. Yuan and I discussed both her books, and I hope you enjoy our conversation. Yuan, you've written two fantastic books, and I'm so thrilled to be able to have a chance to talk with you. Welcome to the show.
Dan, thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate your kind words, and I'm so excited to have this conversation with you today.
Let me start with a very broad question, Yuan, and that has to do with, and you know, I've been studying China for a while. I often go to China. I haven't done so this year, which is really worrisome. And what has always fascinated me is this kind of the success story, right? That about lifting hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. And this is something that perhaps not everybody appreciates in the West, this phenomenal achievement. So why don't I just start by asking you this very general question? How on earth did China achieve this fantastic poverty reduction within a span of just a few decades?
That is a great place to start. We should start with China's phenomenal achievement of poverty reduction. And this morning, just to be sure, I checked the numbers again. It ranges anywhere between 700 million to 850 million people lifted out of poverty, depending on the sources that you look at. And, you know, I think it is only in China where the margin of error is 100 million. In other countries, countries and be like, plus and minus 10,000. But in China, it's like plus and minus 100 million. It's a big number. It's an impressive number. To put things in context, China accounts for at least 2/3 of global poverty reduction. And so I think that begs the biggest question for everyone, which is how China did it. And let me give the short answer. The short answer is rapid national growth. And what my work is about is explaining the political foundation that enables this national growth. And the reason I start with that is that a lot of times when people hear the words poverty reduction, the first thing that comes to mind is aid relief, poverty welfare, or seize poverty campaign. And so when my book came out, almost once every month, I would get a media inquiry asking me to comment on Xi's poverty campaign and poverty, anti-poverty policies. And to which I would reply, I'm sorry, I'm actually not a poverty expert. And the journalists, understandably, would be completely puzzled. And the reason for this is that the first 35 years since market opening in 1978, China reduced that poverty through rapid economic growth. So to understand that, we actually have to understand the politics of growth. And the Xi anti-poverty campaign only began in 2012, when China was already a high middle income economy. And that campaign was focused on targeted poverty relief to take the remaining, to accomplish the last mile of poverty reduction. So that history, that period past 2012 must not be confused with the period before 2012, which was the time when the 700 to 800 million people were lifted out of absolute poverty.
I think that's a great point, you know, because there is this kind of feeling sometimes in the West that it is a recent phenomenon. It is all growth related. But some of the works, of course, you know, in the old days, if you can say so, you know, Amartya Sen and Jean Drez pointed out many years ago that perhaps the seeds of poverty reduction were sown already, you know, 50 years ago. It was much more about investments in human capital, on health and education, and growth further propelled this, but it was this kind of a focus on certain things that were considered to be important that many other countries didn't do. They didn't invest in health and education. So growth in many ways facilitated that initial investments. Do you agree with that?
Definitely the health, the education was part of it. The bigger emphasis that I place in my book is what are the political arrangements that enable entrepreneurship and investment, right? So that would be what Douglas North called institutions. But as a political scientist, I focus particularly on the political institutions.
Right. So your first book, How China Escaped the Poverty Trap, you know, I read it many years ago and I had a look at it recently. And what is particularly interesting is that you actually challenge many of these conventional wisdoms. You basically say that the Chinese example is very different from what you would think is the way to promote economic development, right? So the conventional wisdom that you need good institutions, you need good governance for economic growth, and growth will perhaps also lead to further improvements in governance. Sometimes it may be a question of good enough governance, whatever. But you find that, you know, the Chinese case is a combination of very many things. Mm-hmm. You talk about central reformers in China were perhaps more effective when they were adapting, when they were directing, not when they were dictating. Could you elaborate, please, on this concept of direct improvisation, which is a core feature of that first book of yours on how China escaped the poverty trap?
Sure. And perhaps before I dive into my answers, I think it would be useful for me to say a little bit about my attitudes toward growth itself. And I think that needs to be emphasized because whenever we have a conversation about growth, it tends to go in two directions. Either people become so obsessed with growth as an intrinsic good without thinking about the social costs that come with it. Or they get angry. They were like, oh, Ang only talks about growth and she doesn't acknowledge the other problems that growth creates. And so I think it's necessary to start by saying that my own thinking about capitalist growth after having written two books, it's that growth is important. It's absolutely important because if you want to understand how to take people out of poverty, it's so clear that every single case we've seen in history, mass poverty reduction comes from economic growth and entrepreneurship, not from scientific interventions, right? So growth does matter. But at the same time, when I look at the bigger picture, I realize that capitalist growth necessarily comes at many costs. One of them is corruption. You have inequality. You have environmental degradation. So we have seen all of these costs if we look at the history of the West, if we look at the experience of East Asia, and we now see it on a supersized scale in China, right? So I want to start by kind of prefacing that and acknowledging that I know that capitalist growth is problematic, and I don't claim to know how we can achieve growth without these costs. These costs are real and they're there. But nevertheless, we still want to understand why is it that some countries can manage to produce that growth, whereas many other countries have no growth, plus all of the problems that I've earlier listed, right? So the story of how did China in 1978 was a impoverished communist backwater. I think these days we have forgotten how poor China was. If you look at the numbers, if they are of a useful indication, back then China was actually poorer than Chad and Bangladesh. And then, of course, today I need not repeat, we know how far China has come. And so, in my book, when I try to tackle this big question, which many people before me had tried to do, I realized that, the problem is not that China is complicated, which of course it is. The problem is that the way we think or try to explain really complex outcomes, like economic and social mass transformation, we just don't have the right approach. Our conventional approach in social science is mechanical, right? And I call that a paradigm in the sense of it's a way of thinking, it's a way of seeing the whole world. And a paradigm is made up of a number of assumptions that we take for granted, right? In our everyday life, we operate on paradigms. So, for example, before COVID, you would go out on the streets, you take a bus, you hang out with people. The assumption is that the strangers around you wouldn't hurt you, right? So, we trust strangers. And so assumptions are really crucial to the way we understand the world and the way we function. So when I come back as a social scientist and I look at our paradigm and our assumptions, you can see that there are a number of them. One of these assumptions is that causation is linear, right? So we are constantly looking for what is the X that causes Y, right? What is the thing that causes growth? Or what is the thing that causes institutions? And because we are so fixated with linear causation, we ended up with chicken and egg problems. Meaning, in the context of development, the most you know, widely debated question is it growth that led to good institutions, or is it good institutions that led to growth? That's one of them. And the second assumption is a very atomistic mindset, which means that we see things as separate parts. So either your silver bullet is good institutions, or your silver bullet is capital and labor inputs, or it is something else. And we just don't have a framework for putting things together in a sensible and coherent and yet not simplistic way. And so in order to explain the biggest economic transformation in modern history, it's not just about understanding China. It has to be about deeply revisiting and questioning the assumptions that we hold that shape the world the way we see the world. So how China escaped the poverty trap has a I'm not sure if deceptive is the right word or misleading title, but you look at the title and you may think, oh, this must be a book about Xi's poverty campaign. And then when you open it and China, the word China actually doesn't appear in the book until page 7, I think. Because the first seven pages were about me saying, look, first of all, we don't have the right approach to understanding the world. So we need to see what our limitations are before I can introduce to you my way of telling the story in a whole new angle.
So this is something that most China experts would say, that there's no one China. And I think you do this very well in most of your, all of your work. You're talking about several Chinas. It's a huge country. The different regimes, different eras. You're talking about Mao and Deng and Xi. And this is, you know, there's certain things that happened in the initial years that were carried forward. And we'll discuss more about the corruption issue later on. But in terms of improvisation, Yuan, what does it mean? Is it, as you were saying earlier, that we like clear-cut causal approaches, but when we try to explain China or many other perhaps success stories, it may be somewhat messy, that there are things happening all at once or not necessarily following in some sequential order. You know, roll up your sleeves and just get doing rather than thinking about the conditions that have to exist before the next set of issues can be undertaken.
So the idea of directed improvisation is basically a generic way of understanding what should be the proper role of governance in the economy. And normally we think that the role of government should be to regulate and control, particularly in a planned economy. And what my book shows is that the reason why China has been able to be so dynamic after 78 is that it changed the role of governance. And this very much is credited to the genius of Deng Xiaoping. Deng Xiaoping, when he took over China, he knew that it was important, first and foremost, for the country to have political unity and stability. And for that reason, he capped the apparatus of the Chinese Communist Party. He capped the apparatus of what is essentially a one-party dictatorship. And he also decided not to criticize Mao, which is why we still see Mao on the in Tiananmen. But he knew as well that a one-party autocracy had many problems and dangers, that it was so controlling, that it was ossified, information could not flow, people were just pretending and telling lies, and it just didn't work. So what he did was that he changed the role of the central government. So Beijing went from being a dictator, a commander who told localities what to do, into a director. So it focused its work on creating conducive conditions or the platform for local governments to solve local problems based on local knowledge. So that is the improvisation part. And the reason why I use the term improvisation is that improvisation captures a particular form of adaptation. It means using what you have. So this is another key characteristic that we can find in the Chinese development process, which is that the first step that they took out of escaping poverty is that they use whatever existing resources, features, or structures or institutions that they have. And then they just repurposed it for the purpose of capitalist market growth, right? So this is what I mean by directed improvisation. Beijing being the director and the local governments doing the improvisation. But this concept of directed improvisation is by no means unique to China. It manifests within China in the bureaucracy because it is a state-directed economy. It is a communist system. But you can actually find manifestations of directed improvisation in many other contexts. And one of them, you may be surprised, is the United States. So directed improvisation is by no means unique to China. It manifested in China in a unique way, in the form of a governmental model. But you can find parallels in other places. And one of these parallels, you may be surprised, is the United States. So there is one really insightful book that I would recommend. It's called State of Innovation by Fred Block and Matthew Keller. And when I read the book, this book, by the way, is about the role of the U.S. federal government in technology development in the U.S. And the moment I read the book, I was like, this is directed improvisation, American style. And what it basically tells is the story of how the U.S. federal government facilitated the rise of technological innovation, not by dictating, commanding, or setting targets, or imposing export controls and the like, but by simply focusing on playing the role of a director. So it provided seed funds, it provided collaboration networks between different communities, and it provided the necessary platforms for cooperation. And the equivalent in China is what you saw in the first 30 years of market reform. So this is what I mean by directed improvisation. And with this as an adaptive foundation of governance, we therefore see a whole variety of factors come together at different times in different parts of China. And this is how you can tie all of the threads that I've previously referred to into a single story. And at the core of the story is the role of government, except that it is not the role of government as a commander, but as a director of human creativity.
In both your books, there's this underlying theme, and which really I find fascinating, is the role of the bureaucracy. Because I was, you know, I began doing some work on the bureaucracy, looking at Indian administrative officers and their role in directing development, in implementing development programs. This was in the late 90s. And I remember looking at the literature then, and I was extremely frustrated with the paucity. This is of material. There was just so little about public administration in developing countries. Mm. There was most of the theories, and they still are, dominated by public administration in Western societies. And I find this theme in your book, in both your books, to be really interesting, because in most of this kind of Western discourse in public administration, one talks about the typical, you know, focus on the Weberian principles of bureaucrats being professionals. They're maybe generalists or specialists, but they have to be impartial. There's a distinction between the private and the public spheres. Mm. And all of this makes bureaucrats much more effective. This is important for state capacity. And what I find fascinating in your work is that in terms of your field work in China for both your books, you find actually an administrative structure which is very different from these Weberian bureaucratic norms. And so how did things work out so well in China despite not having this kind of a, you know, Weberian system? How was this possible?
Oh, first of all, let me say that I completely share your frustration with the literature on public administration. And I repeat this, you know, all over my second book. I agree with you. It is Western-centric, right? And it not only is Western-centric, it is ahistorical. So it emphasizes universal best practices that we should copy from the West. And it gives this picture of, to simplify, the West got it right, you know, and therefore it became rich, you know, and these are the Weberian bureaucracies that it puts in place. So it's really frustrating. Back to your question about China. First of all, I have to emphasize that the Chinese system of bureaucracy should not be seen as just a success. Like it's all success and it has no problems. That is not true. The Chinese way of creating a very high-powered, growth-oriented, money-centered bureaucracy created both success and tremendous problems. Because the normative role of a government and a public administration should be, we believe, to serve a variety of needs beyond economic growth, right? We believe that they should care about the quality of services, about equity, about public integrity, and so forth. But what you see in practice in the Chinese system after market opening is that it kind of went on a 180-degree turn from a Maoist radicalized ideological bureaucracy to one where the bottom line was how much money can you make, whether it's tax revenue for your local government, or it's the amount of fees you can collect for your agency, or how rich an official can get. The bottom line became money. So you can say that it is a success to the extent that you have millions of officials who are so committed to getting rich. But of course, it brings a lot of problems. And that is why my second book is on corruption. So I think it's necessary to caveat that.
Yeah, and we'll get to the relationship between corruption and development, which really is fascinating in your second book. But I just want to pursue this thing about the Western or the Weberian bureaucracy idea, Yuan, because I suppose one of the problems is that there are certain examples, most notably in East Asia, where there has been much more of a focus on imitating this kind of a model, right? In terms of, say, in your native Singapore, and you write about this in terms of the Economic Development Board in Singapore or similar agencies in South Korea and Japan. If you know, think about the work by Peter Evans, he's taught me before. I still remember, you know, as a doctoral student, reading about embedded autonomy. Mm-hmm. So most developing countries want to have good bureaucracies, and they see this model that has worked perhaps in the West, but also in East Asia. But they still struggle to achieve this. They don't know how to go about it. Is it about, you know, recruiting people based on merit, which is often a problem? There are no competitive exams. It is often based on, it could be nepotism, contacts. It could be, you know, not getting the best people. And so I wonder, and before we get to the corruption and development nexus, what would you say to countries, to policymakers in many low-income countries that are really struggling to reform their public administration? What is the way forward? What would you suggest based on, say, China's experience, but also your reading of the literature? What would be the most important sets of issues to tackle if one did not follow this typical Weberian model?
Oh, those are really good questions. Let me first quickly comment on your point about the East Asian developmental states. which is a literature that very much inspired my own thinking and interest in development. China is often lumped together with the East Asian states and regarded as the same type, but it is actually very different because the East Asian developmental states were relatively small and highly centralized. So in Singapore's case, right, it is the size of a city, right? There is no centralization or decentralization to speak of. And also in East Asia, as the work of political scientists like Atul Kali shows us, was very deeply influenced by the colonial legacy. So in the case of Singapore, it already had a fairly efficient elitist bureaucracy that was inherited from British rule. When you come to China, people talk about the 5,000 years of Confucian history and so forth, but the reality is that in 1978, the more pressing reality is that China had a communist bureaucracy, right? And this communist bureaucracy was very poorly educated. There was one study that finds that the average years of schooling of local leaders in China at the start of reform was about 7 years. 7 years. Like, these are not well-educated people because they have been born in difficult times and their education was disrupted during the Cultural Revolution when schools were closed for 10 years. And many of the cadres, the ones who were most valued by the party, were people who were poor, who were farmers, who have no elite or rich background. Right? So this was not at all like the kind of bureaucracy that Japan or South Korea or even Taiwan and Singapore had. It was a on the whole, a really massive group of local cadres who were poorly educated, who were radicalized, and who were very locally based, mostly rural. And so it is a completely different challenge when it comes to becoming a developmental state in these circumstances. And that is why, you know, it's part of the reason why I started on the inquiry in my first book. Like, clearly, if you go down to the ground and you interact with these officials, you know they're not barbarian bureaucrats. Like, I come from Singapore. I know what a barbarian bureaucrat looks like. These are not barbarian bureaucrats. And right. So then it doesn't mean that these non-barbarian bureaucrats are failing. Does it mean that they are a kind of deficiency? It's not, right? And so that kind of led me to realize that we have this really strong kind of bias. We have this belief that the only kind of good bureaucracy are the barbarian bureaucracy, the Singaporean types. And then when we look at something like China, you're like, gee, it's not barbarian, but it's not, but this is not like a failed case either. It's something in between. And so that kind of led me to try to explain exactly what it is. And it's essentially a bureaucracy that is infused with entrepreneurial qualities. And these entrepreneurial qualities are, on the one hand, very growth promoting, but on the other hand, it can become corrupt and extractive, right? So this was kind of what led me to really challenge the barbarian model. So it's a good question that you raised.
In the second book, you in many ways continue by challenging conventional wisdom, but the challenging questions in the first continue here. You're again actually questioning conventional wisdom in terms of, and we can start with this, how should we actually understand corruption? Because you're actually arguing that standard measures of corruption are misleading.
Yes.
That we should be unpacking, or as you call it, unbundling corruption in different ways, which perhaps would help better explain the fact, and this is where a lot of people perhaps find it very controversial, that corruption can sometimes be beneficial for development. So can we start first, Ewan, by getting you to reflect a bit on why you think there are certain problematic aspects with the way in which we understand and measure corruption today?
Great. And let me start by again with an important qualifier. I don't argue that corruption is beneficial for development to the extent that we understand development broadly as, you know, quality of life and so forth. I only argue that it stimulates commercial activities, but with perverse consequences, right? So let me come back. Let me come back and say, what are the conventional wisdoms that I challenge in my second book, which is China's Gilded Age? So the first conventional wisdom that I challenge is the idea that corruption is a poor country problem. Like only the poor have corruption and the rich do not. And that is exactly what we see in global indices, right? If you look at the results of global indices, the cleanest country is always the richest, the poorest country is always the most corrupt. And so no surprise, when you run a regression, the correlation between corruption and poverty will always be significant and very strong because it is measured in this way. It is measured to create that result. And I challenge that in this book. I say that we must unbundle corruption into qualitatively different types. And in particular, we must focus on the type of corruption that prevails in rich countries. And I call that excess money, meaning privileges that you pay to powerful political actors, not because you are being harassed or extorted or trying to get a license faster, but because you're trying to get an exclusive deal or privileges. And the richer a country becomes, access money can become more and more legalized and institutionalized, right? This kind of corruption, I show in my book, is systematically undermeasured in global indices. We ignore them. We don't want to talk about them. We don't capture them. And so therefore, we have not paid nearly enough attention to the harm of legalized access money. And the story of China is that it is a newcomer on an evolutionary path that Western countries have taken one or two centuries ago. So by looking at China today, it actually helps us to revisit the past and revisit the conventional wisdom in economic history. So that's my first That's the first point.
So in this case, of course, then you're basically saying that some of these countries are no different. I mean, these developing countries are no different from the United States or Europe. And this is something that I often tell my own students, you know, that there is corruption in Italy. There's corruption in the United States. There's corruption in Europe. There's just it is just not fair to assume that it's only the poorest countries that are corrupt. And I quite like the fact that you emphasize that the kinds of corruption we're talking about in relation to, say, access money is different from the petty corruption or the grand corruption or the corruption of greed. It is different, perhaps, also from speed money. And that when I was reading your second book, it was about the kind of rewards that are extended to certain powerful private sector actors by powerful officials. And these are mutually beneficial. So it's like, you know, win-win. And this can take place in any place. But it seemed to have worked perhaps extremely well in China, right?
Well, Dan, I would say that the corruption in developing countries is different from rich countries.
Okay.
They are the same in that they all have corruption. And you can actually see that in the charts that I provide in my book. They all have corruption. The critical difference is that the type and structure of corruption is different between poor countries and rich countries. So the structure is really the crucial point here. So if you look at the poor country like Bangladesh, it has all types of corruption, from extortion to embezzlement, petty bribery, grant access money, whatever, all kinds of corruption. But if you look at, say, a country like South Korea or look at China, the difference is that they are high on access money, but they are low on other types of corruption. So they have managed to diminish or control embezzlement, petty bribery, extortion, lawless bureaucratic behavior, all of those activities that directly impede economic activities. They have stamped out these kinds of harm, but access money continues to prevail. So there is a difference, and that difference lies in the structure rather than in saying that only poor countries are corrupt and rich countries are not. So that's the critical difference. And then when you come to look at the case of China, that kind of access money corruption, which means that instead of being embezzlement or paying petty bribes because I'm being harassed by the police, corruption in China has been increasingly over the years evolving toward businesses paying big bribes to powerful government officials in exchange for special deals and privileges. That is the dominant form of corruption in China. And I know that as soon as I say this, people would jump to the conclusion that corruption is good for growth. But that's not the whole story, because it is a two-sided story. And that's why I call this form of corruption the steroids of capitalism. It is growth promoting, because when you look at the particular stories that I present in the book, this is a type of corruption where the politician is rewarded for facilitating economic activities. It is not a type of corruption that comes from preventing economic activities. So the example, the counterexample, is India, where the prevalent type of corruption comes from officials throwing hurdles in your way, right? So they would make you apply for 80 licenses and harass you every day and just make things really difficult for businesses.
I remember speaking with Atul Kohli about this many years ago, you know, this whole the transfer, the license Raj. You know, all of these rent-seeking activities of Indian officials.
Exactly. And so in that Indian context, bribes are derived from your ability to block businesses. So, of course, it's growth dampening. And you look at the Chinese case, it is the reverse. Your ability to collect rents comes from your willingness and capacity to facilitate business. And China takes it to the other extreme. So I quoted from one county where the leader had a slogan saying that anyone who obstructs business is a sinner, right? And they speak of it in religious terms, right? So it's almost become like a religion to promote growth. But does it mean that this is beneficial for development? No, because it comes with many other distorting, perverse outcomes, including inequality, including degradation of environment because growth trumps everything else, and including misallocation of capital, because there are certain sectors that are more easily monetized than others. So you see tremendous investment into real estate and building condominiums that only the super rich people can buy. So that is why I have to emphasize that if we insist on using the word good, at best, we could only say the type of corruption in China is good for risky, imbalanced growth. But is that good? It's not good, right? And I know that people may find that unsatisfying because, hey, I want you to tell me what is the silver bullet to this utopian world where there is rapid growth and absolutely no social costs. I don't have the silver bullet. I've never found one. I've never found a country that has come a long way without creating a lot of problems along. I don't have a single example in my mind. I can tell you in the Chinese case that yes, they have achieved great transformation within one generation, but at significant social cost and with perverse consequences that they are still trying to deal with today.
You know, in one part of your book, I think I read this heading, corrupt but competent. In many ways, that sums up this. And you argue that leaders or political careers are shaped by both performance and patronage. And it is really about, as you were saying, about profit sharing, right? It's like we're all in it together. You know, I don't get much money from salaries, but I don't want more from the central government, my basic salary. If I can show some innovation, I can attract investments, maybe I can get some other fringe benefits. And together, maybe that would be an attractive thing for me. But I wanted to ask you something about, you know, as I, this is just a personal experience, the last 15 years, 10, 15 years, I've been going to China regularly. And this question that a lot of people ask me about gift giving, you know, the kind of relationships that I, you know, whenever I'm at a dinner, there's always these gift bags that are packed and people's cars, the boot, the trunks are full of ready-made gifts because you don't want to be caught not having a gift. I'm always in that situation. I feel like my books that I give are just not very attractive gifts. So it's this kind of a culture where, you know, you show appreciation and you give gifts, and it is this kind of building relationships, you know, showing gratefulness or just saying that, you know, I appreciate this gesture. Do you think there's something there that maybe it's not always a clear-cut distinction between what, you know, is a bribe or what is more, I don't know, it's just the kind of relationship that you don't want to be impolite. Is there something there in terms of how we should understand some of these acts that may be termed as corrupt, but maybe are not always perceived to be corrupt in a Chinese context?
I think you are asking a question about culture, right? Cultural perceptions.
That's correct.
Of corruption. Yes. And, you know, your anecdote reminds me of my own experience. I agree that gift giving is such a predominant culture in China that every time I visit China, I have this at least one whole luggage filled with gifts.
Right.
And I'm always trying, like, please give it out as quickly as possible so I don't have to carry all these bags with me. But so I relate to your experience. That's what I was trying to say. How I think about this is that, sure, on a daily basis, your interaction with friends and acquaintances, the gift giving is a cultural practice. And it is also a deep cultural practice in the sense that it's not like someone would give you a gift and then immediately ask a favor of you, right? So sometimes it's just giving a gift as a kind of friendliness to build a relationship. A favor may or may not be asked to you, but it, to the extent that it is a culture, it's just a practice of building up friendly relations so that if time comes to ask for a favor, I'm more likely to get one, right? And I don't.
So it's like an investment in the future, right? I mean, it's just.
It's an investment in relationships, you know? And in my view, I don't think that it's uniquely Chinese at all. You can take the word investing in relationship and put it like on a Goldman Sachs advertisement. And okay. It works just as well, right? And so on a daily basis, it's gift giving is a culture, and that is not corruption. I think when you get to the kind of cases that I study in my book about grand corruption, I don't think that those individuals involved in those cases have any doubt in their mind that they are engaging in corruption. I don't think that they are so naive to think that, oh, you know, it's just a culture of gift giving. No, at that level, with those stakes, where the gift is not a book, it's not a souvenir, you know, it's like a condominium, I'm sure that the parties involved know what is at stake when the thing being exchanged is of such high value. So that is why I don't make cultural arguments about corruption in my book. At a very high level, people know what they're doing. And also at a very high level where high stakes are exchanged, it's not uniquely Chinese. It happens in every society where, you know, powerful and intelligent people find ways to advance their own interests.
One part of your book, I was fascinated with these two case studies of political superstars, leaders like Bo Xilai, who were seen to be extremely successful and who were suddenly brought down by allegations of corruption. And I really like the fact that you emphasize in large parts of the book that political administrative elites have both career as well as financial incentives to foster development. But not everybody, you know, wants to go about promoting economic growth very enthusiastically, because when you do that, you may end up perhaps being, or you may end up cultivating ties to certain business interests. If you are a political leader, you give certain favors to these people. And, you know, you both, as a political leader, of course, your star power increases, you're getting national importance, the person or the private sector actor that you're giving favors to is also making a lot of money. And all of this is, you know, you're sharing the profits and everybody's benefiting, until, of course, somebody is accused of corruption, and then the whole thing falls apart. Whoever was part of this machinery or involved in any way is affected. But what I actually quite like is also the fact that you say that not everybody is really looking for this kind of political stardom, that some people, they want to promote growth, but sometimes they just don't want to go right to Beijing. They may be comfortable just, you know, a certain level of growth. They don't need to really outdo anybody else. And so in that sense, maybe the incentive may be more financial. Have I understood you correctly?
So I think you are referring to the part of my book about corrupt and competent officials. And if I That's understand correct. Correctly, you're probably referring to the stories which I talked in the appendix about some officials who are not ambitious. Is that what you had in mind?
Yeah, I'm referring to both the stories of those who were ambitious, and then there were some who were not.
Right.
You know, they're two very different stories. So it's not just like everybody is ambitious and everybody wants political power. Some people say, no, I'm fine where I am.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up. It's one of the few times where I sort of regret putting the story in the appendix. So if people are interested, I you might want to check out. There are these. So let me get back to the whole chapter. The chapter is about explaining one of the central paradoxes in the Chinese political system, which is that a lot of the corrupt officials are actually famous for being highly competent. And Bo Xilai is one of them. He's the most famous or notorious of all. But there are many others, you know, simultaneously corrupt and competent. And then in addition to this dominant type, there are other varieties of officials. And these are the ones that I put in the appendix. And one of them, which I use as sort of an exemplifier, is an official who is not corrupt and not competent. And his name is Liu Mingqian. And I thought his story was really fascinating because he is actually kind of famous for being morally upright, and he didn't commit corruption. He would dine in the canteen, and he would pack his own dinner. So he was not involved in banquets or deal making, and he was the kind who just wanted to be safe in his position and then retire peacefully. Nevertheless, he was still held responsible for corruption, and then fired because he was in a city where a vote buying scandal broke out. So there were businesses trying to buy their way, buy their seats into the Congress, and because this scandal broke out when he was the leader, he was held responsible for it. So that's how the Chinese definition of corruption does not is not limited to just taking bribes. If you were found incompetent, that's also considered corruption, and you can be fired for that. So he was in of that variety, and what was interesting in Liu Mingqian's case is that even the Chinese media were very condescending toward him, And they were like, this guy, you know, he's not corrupt, but that's precisely his problem. He has no spying. And so the Chinese culture is at least today, is despises officials who are not decisive and strong. And so he fell, but he was not appreciated at all for being morally upright. Whereas if you look at how people perceive Bo Xilai or Ji Jianye, the corrupt and competent officials, there's a kind of mixed feelings, you know, and some of them are genuinely loved by residents despite their corruption. And so I think that's quite revealing about public perception in China and about what it takes to rise and survive in China's political system. Even if you choose to be really conservative and not corrupt, it doesn't mean that you'll be safe in your seat, because as soon as something goes wrong, you can still be blamed for it. And nobody would have appreciated you for being weak.
Yuan, the problem of writing two fantastic books is that I have just so many things I'd like to talk to you about. And your books are so rich in empirical material, hundreds of interviews, methodological innovation. You know, you really have done a fantastic job. But we don't have so much time. So a final set of issues I wanted to discuss with you, and that has to do with the kind of sustained campaign, as you put it, that the current president Xi has undertaken since 2013, in terms of prosecuting corrupt officials. And I was fascinated that you provide these numbers that between 2012 and 2017, apparently there were 12 million tips and reports from the public, and there were 2.7 million leads. 1.5 million cases were investigated. 1.5 million individuals were disciplined. I mean, this is just mind-boggling. Criminal charges were pressed against 58,000 offenders. And all of this ranged from warning letters and pep talks to removal of, you know, party membership, demotion, dismissal, criminal prosecution, you name it. And so I'm just wondering, how effective is this? Has it got people to be really afraid? I know that a lot of my colleagues now don't invite me to these lavish dinners anymore. They're cutting back on expenses and all those fancy gifts. So I know there's much more in recent years, this kind of fear that you're not supposed to pursue a lavish lifestyle. You don't want to attract undue attention. But my question really is, how effective has this sustained strategy been? Because you make this point in the book that this is quite unusual, because this kind of anti-corruption campaigns are often episodic. But in this case, it's lasted and it continues. So, you know, what is the future of this kind of anti-corruption campaign? Is it effective? Is it having an impact? Is it actually having an adverse impact on economic growth? Or in terms of the entrepreneurial efforts, are people like holding back now because they have to be so careful?
Oh, the short answer would be mixed outcomes. But I'm glad you highlighted the paragraph of those numbers, because bear in mind, the margin of error is 100 million, right? So plus and minus 100 million. So numbers in China are always very big. It is a very populous country and a populous bureaucracy. The short answer to your question is mixed results. Has it terrified officials and made them very careful of not engaging or being perceived of engaging in corruption? Oh, absolutely. The effects are broad and they're deep and they're strong. And so it has created both good and bad. Good in the sense that the crony capitalism that was happening in China was really getting out of control. And by the time Xi took office in 2012, his arrival in office was preceded by the Bo Xilai scandal, right? And it really showed just how bad crony capitalism had become, to the extent that officials were so enriched that they could defy the central. So that, on the one hand, was a necessary strong action to take. But on the other hand, the it had a real chilling effect on the bureaucracy, which is why it eventually created a new kind of bureaucratic problem known now in China as lazy governance. And the state council actually had to warn the individuals against being lazy, which is very unusual in Chinese politics because Chinese bureaucrats, if anything, are known for being over-enthusiastic rather than being lazy. And so that is the backlash to this strong action. So in short, for any given policy in China, because it is almost always extreme, the outcome is mixed. It's never a complete success story, even on the front of economic growth. There's always this impressive result, but we must always remember that this impressive result comes with some serious backlash as well. And this is true of almost every dimension of policy implementation in China.
Yuan, it was such a pleasure to speak to you today. I really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you so much for coming on my podcast.
Oh, thank you so much, Dan. Well, thank you so much for your time. And you are such a thoughtful interviewer that it's very easy to kind of think through things and make nuanced arguments. It's really because you are such a talented interviewer. You make people think.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please spread the news among your friends and share it on social media. The Twitter handle for this podcast is GlobalDevPod.
Thank you for listening to In Pursuit of Development with Professor Dan Banik from the University of Oslo Center for Development and the Environment. Please email your questions, comments, and suggestions to inpursuitofdevelopment@gmail.com.